Welcome to TOTE's Post Roe v. Wade podcast series, hosted by a multidisciplinary team of attorneys discussing the potential Supreme Court overturn of Roe v. Wade and its impact on employers, professionals, healthcare providers, data and privacy service providers, educational institutions, and investors.
Hello, and welcome to all of our listeners today. This is the Choate Holland Stewart podcast series about potential legal consequences if Roe versus Wade is overturned in line with the leaked Supreme Court draft opinion in the Dobbs versus Jackson case. My name is Julia Hesse. I'm the co-chair of the healthcare group here at Choate. With me today is Sarah Rao, an associate in our healthcare group. 26 states have passed or have proposed legislation that will spring into effect if Roe v. Wade is overruled or fundamentally weakened. Some of these bans have multiple laws on the books that prevent or restrict abortion access, or have state constitutions that specifically bar the right to abortion. Today, we will discuss the impact these bans may have on the fertility industry. For context, approximately 55,000 babies each year are born in the United States through the use of IVF. Routine IVF activities include the fertilization of eggs to create embryos, and testing, freezing, transfer, and discarding of embryos. Embryos are used for research purposes and donated to those who are not able to create embryos with their own genetic material. So, Sarah, what aspects of the fertility process could be made illegal under these new state laws?
There are multiple stages of the fertility process that providers are concerned could be made illegal, now or in the future, as a result of state laws that are intended to restrict or prevent abortion. A key concern for fertility providers is how some states with anti-abortion trigger laws, like Tennessee, Arkansas, and Kentucky, already define embryos as unborn children at the moment of fertilization. In Louisiana, lawmakers advanced a bill last week that would criminalize abortion in the state and grant constitutional rights to, quote, all unborn children from the moment of fertilization. One big question, which may not seem obvious, is when does fertilization occur?
In the IVF context, the fertilization of egg with sperm and creation of an embryo occurs in a lab. The embryo must grow into a blastocyst, which typically takes 5 to 7 days before it's transferred into a person's uterus. So, of course, this begs the question. Are embryos considered to be unborn children subject to these laws prior to implantation in a person's uterus? And Sarah, do these existing trigger laws, as currently drafted, specifically define any pre-implantation, meaning pre-pregnancy IVF intervention, as something like an abortion?
No. The existing anti-abortion trigger laws prohibit termination of a pregnancy or regulate embryos only once the embryo is, quote, within a person's body. But the fact that these state laws declare embryos as having legal existence or legal personhood gives rise to a concern that any activity that could destroy or damage an embryo could result in liability to a fertility provider. Julia, what about other unused embryos? How could they be treated under restrictive state laws?
Individuals who undergo IVF may choose to freeze unused embryos for later use or for backup if a pregnancy is ultimately unsuccessful. It's also very common for unused embryos to be donated for research use, donate to another person to attempt a pregnancy, or to be destroyed. If an embryo is considered an unborn child, can these routine activities of transfer, research, and discard be conducted? Even if these standard IVF activities are not restricted now, the existence of these fetal personhood or life begins at fertilization laws may have a chilling effect on an individual seeking IVF services. Sarah, what do these laws mean for routine pre-implantation genetic testing of embryos?
It is standard of care for embryos to be tested for genetic anomalies prior to being implanted in a person's uterus. On average, about half of all embryos have anomalies of some kind, and current standard of care calls for destruction of embryos that show such anomalies. This genetic testing takes place on blastocysts, so clearly occurs post-fertilization, but prior to when the embryo is implanted, so prior to pregnancy. But in states that have declared life to begin at fertilization, there is a clear tension between the laws prohibiting termination of a pregnancy and the silence in the law about destruction of embryos prior to implantation. Julia, what other routine aspects of IVF have also had their legality called into question?
Well, Sarah, many providers are concerned that standard of care procedures designed to maximize the chance of achieving a pregnancy through IVF while minimizing the risks associated with multiple births, meaning twins, triplets, or more, may be deemed illegal under restrictive state laws. In the United States, it is quite common for an IVF procedure for multiple embryos to be implanted because not every embryo that is implanted results in a pregnancy. Carrying multiples comes with additional risk, though, both to the ultimate success of a pregnancy and to the health of the mother. So if a patient is implanted with multiple embryos that result in multiple pregnancies, it's common for the medical team to discuss with the patient whether to engage in selective termination or termination of one or more of the fetuses to maximize the chance of a healthy birth of a single child. This procedure would typically occur in the first trimester, prior to 12 weeks of gestation. Under the restrictive state laws that define life as beginning at the moment of conception, or in many states that have criminalized termination of a pregnancy after 6 weeks, selective termination would be considered abortion punishable under those state laws. So, Sarah, what should IVF patients and providers be doing in light of all of these concerns?
IVF providers and patients should keep a close eye on legislative developments in their state. There is a massive amount of legislative activity on this topic, and many laws have passed very quickly, often without the opportunity for robust input from all stakeholders, such as the IVF community. While some states with recently passed restrictive trigger laws have incorporated exceptions for IVF procedures into their statutes, these exceptions are often not detailed and are difficult to interpret. As patients and providers have had the opportunity to voice their concerns about their state laws, it is possible that certain laws could be amended to address the issues we have raised here. In the meantime, though, IVF patients and providers should monitor developments in their state closely and should reach out to their legislative representatives if they are concerned about how their state's laws will impact their access to IVF services.
Wow. Well, thank you for your insight, Sarah. And for those of you listening, thank you for joining us. We hope you found this podcast valuable.
For more information, please visit www.choate.com. You can also listen to additional podcast episodes in the newsroom of our website and subscribe to them wherever you listen to podcasts, including iTunes, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. The information presented in this recording is for educational purposes only. It does not constitute legal advice for a specific situation. If you wish to obtain legal advice, you should retain an attorney and explain the facts of your particular situation.